Welcome to the 2019 Higginbotham Lecture. It's wonderful to see so many people here in this magnificent venue. Please note the lecture is being filmed and recorded by ABC TV and radio. Make sure your phones are switched off or on silent mode, please. I'm Anthony Forsyth, professor in the Graduate School of Business and Law, and shortly I'll introduce our guest speaker. RMIT University acknowledges the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations as the traditional owners of the land on which the university stands. RMIT respectfully recognises their elders past and present. This annual lecture celebrates the legacy of George Higginbotham, a prominent Victorian politician and Chief Justice in the late 19th century. Higginbotham was a supporter of liberal causes, including the women's suffrage movement. He was also instrumental in establishing the Working Men's College, which formed the foundations of modern-day RMIT University. This is a really important event to us in the RMIT Graduate School of Business and Law, and I especially welcome our students who are here tonight. The lecture highlights our connections with the legal and human rights communities in Victoria and nationally. And we're delighted to be hosting Craig Foster this evening. He follows in the footsteps of Emeritus Professor Gillian Triggs, the Honourable Marcia Neave, the Honourable Michael Kirby, and others who have delivered lectures in this series. I first thought of Craig as the ideal person to speak on human rights earlier this year, after he led the successful international campaign for the release of Hakeem Al-Arabi. And we're very pleased to welcome Hakeem as well as our special guest here tonight. So I stalked Craig on LinkedIn. I emailed him an invitation to deliver the lecture, and to my delight, he replied immediately to say that he would. And this was despite the fact that I had foolishly led with my support of Blackburn Rovers and not his beloved Crystal Palace. Craig will be known to many of you as the face of SBS football, along with his colleague, Lucy Zelich. He's a former captain of the Socceroos, a winner of 3 Logie Awards, and just recently an AFR Boss True Leader Award for the Save Hakeem campaign, which he's going to speak about. In recent years, Craig has become a leading Australian public figure. He's shown how effectively the power of sport can be marshalled in support of human rights. Among many other roles, he's an Amnesty Refugee Ambassador, a member of the Human Rights Watch Australia Committee, and the Australian Multicultural Council. He has a Master's in Sports Management, and in his spare time at the moment, he's completing a law degree, not with us at RMIT. I was trying to work on that, but he's nearly finished. Craig is speaking on the topic tonight, Sport and Human Rights, Can Sport Change the World? His lecture will issue a challenge to professional sports people, sporting codes and fans to move beyond just playing and watching the game and to think about the human rights of citizens, spectators, players, those who build the stadiums and those who are excluded from them across the globe. Could you all please warmly welcome Craig Foster?
Thank you very much. Finally, this nightmare has ended. I'm very happy to see everyone happy with me at this moment. Thank you for all my support, and I would like to say thank you, Australia, the wife of Hakeem Al-Arabi. Powerful sentiments from new Australian citizen Hakeem Al-Arabi's wife, and a sound starting point for tonight's exploration of sport's social obligation to positively change the world. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, elders past, present and emerging, and that truth-telling, recognition and reparation to our First Nations, when that is made, the soul of this beautiful ancient land will be made whole. It's a great pleasure to accept the invitation to speak with you. However, I will point out that, although termed a lecture, this is the very thing I wish to avoid. Rather, I believe that we all need to come together to discuss important, often difficult issues as Australians and as global citizens to create the country and the world in which we can live together in harmony. Tonight we will challenge the global sports industry further and ask whether sport might contribute to saving the world by making a decisive contribution to the fruition of the unfulfilled dream of the past three quarters of a century for a truly universal standard of human conduct. My thesis is that sport can do so through two core aspects: the social currency of athletes to amplify important discussions, and most powerfully, the sport and rights movement, which gives credence to the athlete's message, brings sport and athletes together in a shared advocacy, and is enabling the promotion of international rights instruments on a truly global level. We will extrapolate lessons from the campaign to free Hakim early this year and ask whether anything has changed. Along the way, I'll again call on FIFA to urgently abide by their human rights obligations, propose that a rights focus increases the legitimacy of the athlete voice, urge Australia to join the movement, including the need for a sports and rights institute, and highlight my concerns about climate migration and how football is uniquely impacted. A mighty challenge in the next 40 minutes, undoubtedly. In fact, we could say we're aiming for the title, going for the double. You get the point, and best prepare yourself for plenty more sporting metaphors and truisms. Ready, set, but will sport go where it as yet daren't? Sport is in large part powerful because it brings humans together on the basis of shared agreed rules. In football, the field represents contest boundaries fairly drawn. 211 countries come together of every background, religion, race, colour and gender, and are equal. It teaches us to be global citizens, and the concept of sport and its players advocating for global standards of human interaction is completely natural to our mind. So we shouldn't be surprised when, given athletes' careers depend on the fair application of rules, they take visceral offence at and feel a need to use their voice to expose injustice in their sport, community or world. In fact, we should welcome it, and by bringing human rights into the athlete's lens, their protests become more impactful. Of course, historians know that sport by its very nature has an element of defiance built into its competitive fabric. When the Blues and Greens chariot teams about to race in 532 AD in Constantinople demanded that the emperor pardon from execution, several of their, what we'd now call fans or supporters, Justinian's refusal set off 6 weeks of rioting and the deaths of 30,000. Although the presidents of sporting organisations have not infrequently been accused of acting like quasi-emperors, we thankfully did not need to act quite so destructively earlier this year when campaigning to free our young friend from a Bangkok prison, of which more later. We have countless examples of athlete activism which were founded on breaches of humanitarian principles that needed to be illuminated. Even if sport didn't conflate the two, which is a defining characteristic of many of the most iconic moments in sporting history. Internationally, for example, the raised black gloves in the 1968 Olympic Games to protest racial discrimination is iconic for the very reason that it stood against not only prejudice, but prevailing social wisdom and policy, both sport and government of the day. Athletes have the same frailties and flaws as anyone else. They are not superhuman. Rather, it is their refusal to give in to these weaknesses that is so meritorious. We see desirable qualities in their struggles and triumphs, and even in their very public failures are lessons to be drawn. And we live vicariously through their journey because it is ours, only on camera. So when I talk about athlete voice, I'm not referring to moral worthiness or the role model trope. Rather, I'm proposing we accept that sport and its most famous proponents have social power which is very well earned. The question is how they spend it. We are all aware of prominent athletes who answer the responsibility to return the support and opportunities that they've been provided. And in my view, it's in supporting a civil society, fundamental human rights, and advocating for humanitarian values that this debt is repaid. I argue that it is through a rights-based approach that the athlete is liberated from the constraints of political or commercial concerns that sport often imposes, whether explicitly or implicitly. It allows them to use their voice to support those being violated and to educate the next generation about the rights they hold individually and between each other as equal members of the human race. Surely, free and equal in dignity and rights, endowed with reason and acting towards one another in a spirit of brother and sisterhood is the very essence of the sporting ethos, is it not? In the domestic context, when four-time Paralympian Kurt Fearnley or wheelchair tennis and basketball dual international Dylan Alcott challenged perceptions of what an athlete can achieve in a wheelchair, hurtling headlong down the track or across the court with immense courage and dexterity one moment, and advocating for the rights of the disabled in the next, they fertilise the rights of others. When proud Adnya Mathanya and Nurunga man Adam Goods performs a beautiful, stirring, ancient Aboriginal war dance with such unmistakable pride in his culture and people, how must this resonate with Indigenous youth who are facing discrimination and wondering, can I really succeed by being a black man, or must I act white or grey or some shade in between? Then they see an Aboriginal man, proud to the depths of his soul, standing for Indigenous rights, and this progresses the case for reform. And when our most loved national sporting team, the Matildas, challenge the heavily discriminatory FIFA prize money distribution, it's important, not only to other teams globally and women's sport generally, but the cause of gender equality itself. So too, when LGBTI members of the team, such as Chloe Legazzo, stand proudly in who they are. Likewise, the admirable US Women's National Team captain, Megan Rapinoe, and it says to young girls that you're perfect as you are. Sport can shift conversations because it's a very rare phenomenon, a social institution where we share lasting emotions in a predominantly safe way with tribalism that means little in a substantive sense, but is hugely enjoyable nonetheless, and perhaps more so for this very reason. As the Polish Pope John Paul II famously said in relation to my game, amongst all unimportant subjects, football is the most important. And that is precisely the point. It will be even more important, though, when sporting bodies accept the right of athletes to promote and protect other humans. And we will return to this friction in a moment. Australians feel good about, and we join together through sport in a way that's arguably of ever-increasing value in a fractious world. If sport is the universal language of the world, then how powerful can it be in the promulgation of universal rights? We have the perfect probative example of the fusion of sport and rights in the campaign to free Hakim, who was facing the threat of refoulement to Bahrain from where he fled, having been tortured as part of the crackdown on high-profile athletes in the Arab Spring. Granted a protection visa in Australia, he bravely spoke out in 2016 against then FIFA presidential election candidate and president of the Asian Football Confederation, Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa, which likely cost Salman the most powerful seat in world sport. Salman was president of the Bahrain Football Federation when Hakim was incarcerated and tortured years before, and yet did not come to his aid. Late last year, Hakim and his young wife travelled on their honeymoon to Bangkok and were detained on an improper Interpol red notice at Bahrain's request, pending extradition. The challenge of the campaign to free him was to maintain a rigorous focus on a multi-partisan, apolitical message, even more so because his case was potentially so politically charged. A young Muslim male at a time when some of this community have rightly expressed feelings of marginalisation in Australian society, and a refugee who came to Australia by plane, which somehow makes one different to the poor souls who undertake the journey in a barely, if not unseaworthy, vessel. Hakim was then a plain person, and his good fortune, and I use the term advisedly, as the young man has suffered detestable treatment at the hands of several governments, was to play football. You see, not only did this mean that the international community could be activated in his defence, and that his status as a sports person made him more relatable, more human than the millions of other equally as worthy asylum seekers, He also had the benefit of the entire international human rights framework. In fact, he had greater recourse to international standards as a registered footballer than he did under Australian, Bahraini or Thai domestic law. Following the awarding of FIFA World Cups to both Russia and Qatar and the associated human cost and reputational damage from discriminatory laws or the deaths of migrant workers, the human rights community was able to encourage football to adopt a robust human rights policy. This obligates official bodies to promote all internationally recognised human rights. Though crises were the genesis and implementation of its provisions is an ongoing challenge, as we'll touch on shortly, I congratulate the governing body for having made the strongest commitment in international sport. Are we now seeing sport brought back inside the international rule of law in a world where sport has created its own lex sportiva, a so-called global law without the state? It is immensely exciting to consider what we may achieve in a bold new world where sport must uphold the universal values which are in reality anything but universal. Because while the principles of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights have been embedded in the constitutions or domestic law of over 90 countries, FIFA's membership stands at a hefty 211. Qatar is proof that while adherence to or domestic implementation of UN instruments is voluntary, membership of global sport is something that citizens will not see put at risk. Restrict free press, discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and against women's rights, sure. But get kicked out of FIFA, no way. Can football achieve what domestic law and its 211 member federations is often unwilling or incapable? Article 7 of the FIFA Human Rights Policy of 2017 states, for example, that where national laws and regulations and international human rights standards differ or are in conflict with each other, FIFA will follow the higher standard without infringing upon domestic laws and regulations. Where the national context risks undermining FIFA's ability to ensure respect for internationally recognised human rights, FIFA will constructively engage with the relevant authorities and other stakeholders and make every effort to uphold its international human rights responsibilities. Now, we had to make an undue effort to acquire every effort from FIFA, and the reality is that the players, public, Australian government and sport and rights movement saved him, not the institutional football system. Nevertheless, it's vital to understand that the football federations of Thailand and Bahrain were obligated to protect Hakim's rights under the convention relating to the status of refugees and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment and Punishment, rather than domestic refugee or human rights law. Most failed miserably to do so, but in the past we would have merely been appealing to their better nature, morality or values of the game. And I need not remind the human rights or legal fraternity about the efficacy of that approach when money, self-interest or politics are involved, as all three almost always are in contemporary sport. This also meant that the international sport and human rights community who led the creation of the groundbreaking policy were deeply committed to its obedience and poised to apply leverage on government and sporting stakeholders alongside the global campaign. More than once did we reflect throughout that if Hakim was a swimmer, table tennis player or a sprinter, for example, he may still be in that prison cell. His expertise with a round ball begat trouble due to his profile in 2012 and saved his life in 2019. Hakim stands with us today as a living reminder of what Australia can achieve in the name of humanity, compassion and empathy. And I believe one day these qualities will be acknowledged as national strengths, not weaknesses. And of how we can overcome the dizzying barrage of messages that dehumanise real, living and breathing human beings, families, kids. Let us hope that Hakim's case can be a light in the darkness from which we can navigate a way forward. Australians are compassionate, has been proven for Hakim. And I feel sure that too many of us have had enough of the constant stories of suffering of people who sought refuge. As the families of so many of you in the audience tonight and listening or reading around the nation have done or would do in the same circumstances, as would I. I had the profound pleasure of working with one who became an icon, Laszlo Erge, his name was, Les Murray, whose family paid people smugglers to get to Australia from Hungary in 1957, and for whom sport was the propellant, through broadcasting, to a life of celebrated achievement and recognition from the governments of both Australia and Hungary. In the eyes of every asylum seeker, I see haunting images of these two. And I cannot work with someone that Australia loved or come to know this amazing young new Australian named Hakeem and his extraordinary wife, and yet look away when the Leses or Hakeems of today are being harmed. And I pray, Australia, neither can you. I do believe the better nature of Australians, which I know and Hakeem shows exist, will prevail. Because if Hakeem is proof of anything, it's that when we stand for what is right and just, we can achieve extraordinary things. We need our political leaders to come together as people and find a better path forward for us all. We'll need to be pragmatic, and there may be no perfect answer. But move forward we must, please. Given the multicultural DNA of football in this country and the vast number of refugees who we play with and against every weekend on pitches all around the nation, our community has a wonderful opportunity to raise our voice in support of humane treatment of all, as they did for Hakeem. And that's not politics. That's pure human rights. And here's where athletes can ground their advocacy safely in an apolitical place. They can know that human rights transcend sports and governments. When we advocate for humane laws and treatment of vulnerable people based on international instruments, it's not about the political right, left or centre. We are all united through our immutable rights that underpin or sit above politics, whichever you prefer. This is why in the Save Hakeem campaign, I was careful to work with all parties, all leaders, and continue to do so, to demonstrate that there are fundamental standards and values which exist independently of any policy, and advocating for vulnerable people is certainly one. The problem is that Hakeem was a unique victim in many ways, a footballer, a refugee, based in Australia where there's a national reverence for sport, a strong player union framework, an ethos of solidarity between athletes, and a generation of former players with three decades of experience fighting for player rights. Without the decisive work of Foreign Minister Maurice Payne and the Australian Ambassador-designate Alan McKinnon and his embassy staff in Bangkok, along with the strong public support of the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, he would have been beyond our reach. Nevertheless, the FIFA policy provided a benchmark for accountability in what was a seminal test of the new sports world. But there are other victims in sport who don't possess these advantages, and for them the system must operate satisfactorily. It does not. At a time when we should be focused on the incredible global opportunity for women's rights through sport, the failure of the system has resulted in tragedy. Sadly, in the past week, we've seen the death of an Iranian female football fan, Sahar Khodiari, who self-immolated in protest at the Iranian government's discriminatory refusal to allow women to attend football matches. Despite statutory gender equality provisions, FIFA has watched women being detained, imprisoned, and beaten, all the while failing to impose the sanction of suspension or expulsion that is expressly provided for. It is significant that, although FIFA made clear that sporting sanctions on Bahrain and Thailand were not possible in Hakeem's case, our insolent promotion of the threat of being kicked out of international competition cut through deeply to the Thai football-loving population. The Asian Confederation has done too little for the women of Iran, as they did nothing for Hakeem, and as well as holding the AFC to account for a fast-growing list of abuses, I call on FIFA to apply their statutes immediately and ban the Islamic Republic of Iran from international competition until such time as women have equal rights to watch football. Until this happens, equality is a lie that is putting lives at risk. The Iranian women campaigned for years, but where could they prosecute their case? As this audience well knows, rights and policies are one thing, remedy another. This is the next step of the sport and human rights journey, which raises the question as to whether a new remedial chamber is necessary, one with specific human rights expertise that the Court of Arbitration for Sport, CAS, for example, lacks. Point made by former UN Secretary General Special Representative for Business and Human Rights, Professor John Ruggie of Harvard. This is even more critical in light of the failure of the electoral eligibility criteria and FIFA Code of Ethics to hold officials to account, such as, for example, the president of Iranian football, Mehdi Taj, who was elected in April as a vice president of the AFC amid the complete failure of his governing body to protect Saha and her colleagues. Similarly, the Secretary General of the Afghanistan Football Federation, Syed Ali Reza Aghazadeh, was elected to the Executive Committee of the Asian Football Confederation, even though at the time suspended by the Afghan Attorney General's office for alleged sexual abuse of women national team players. The Global Players Body, FIFPro, also needs to do more, in my view, as a former chairman of our domestic union. Despite a flagrant breach of his human rights obligations to Hakim, the AFC president Salman remains beyond challenge, has garnered Australia's vote for re-election, and calls for accountability are illusory. It is FIFPro's responsibility to challenge any official whose conduct threatens player safety and to impress the highest standards of governance of the sport. How are officials who stood by when the Afghan women were abused, when the Iranian women fans faced discrimination which led to an avoidable death, when Hakim was facing certain torture, still being elected to high office? We have to ask whether we've learned anything from the Save Hakim campaign. Saha's blood has been spilt, and football will try to avoid answering on whose hands it lies. But what's most pressing is, who is going to ask? When fans' or players' rights are in jeopardy, officials have to deliver, and Saha stands as the tragic cost of delay that we feared Hakim would become. And this is precisely why we confronted the politics of the game head-on by gate-crashing FIFA, refused to let political compromise shape the outcome, and forced football to act. But we shouldn't have to. When sport uses its newfound humanitarian muscle, the effects can be extremely powerful, not just for one young man, but countries and continents. We can only wonder what effect embedding human rights provisions in bidding contracts for mega sporting events might have in future, given the disastrous consequences of many sectors of society when the roadshow descends. And the trend towards sport washing or using mega events to burnish a country's image and bury human rights abuses increases the urgency to give affected people a sporting chance. Child labour, supply chain abuse and construction worker deaths are but a molecule of the historic human impact of FIFA World Cups and Olympic Games. The displacement of vulnerable people from event zones for construction or competition alone reached as many as 1.5 million at Beijing 2008, saw 9,000 homeless citizens issued with a citation as part of the Clean the Streets program for Atlanta 96, most of them African Americans, as well as the forced eviction of 30,000. Between 250,000 and 1.5 million for Brazil 2014 World Cup, and a further 6,600 families for Rio 2016. Awarding of the FIFA World Cup to Qatar in 2010 was destined to increase the number of migrant workers required in the construction of a reported $200 billion worth of infrastructure, and the consequent restriction of the movement of workers, confiscation of passports, non-payment of wages and unsafe working conditions, leading to serious injury and death. you get the point. Which is that prior to human rights policies in sport, these horrendous impacts were largely considered the host nation's problem, no longer. Now, sport must account for its own business and force states to adapt. And that's hugely exciting for the world we want to see. Late last year, for example, Qatar made long-awaited changes to its labour code and kafala system that removed the right of employers to deny exit permits to migrant workers. Much more needs to be done, but sport created an important first step, one that saves lives. And in a significant sign of positive change, human rights considerations were one factor taken into account in FIFA's decision not to extend the Qatar World Cup from 32 to 48 teams, which would have necessitated matches being held in neighbouring countries with ongoing breaches of international standards, such as Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Saudi Arabia, or the UAE. What pressure, I ask, might this bring for reform? The International Olympic Committee responded to concerns relating to the human rights impacts of the Games through provisions in the operational requirements of its host city contract, and an advisory committee on human rights, chaired by Prince Zayed Al Hussein, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who is reviewing the institutional need for policy, which is an opportunity for further progress. Another test is looming, though, for IOC and Olympic athletes with the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and the egregious abuse being perpetrated on the Uyghur population in northwestern China, for which the hosts can rightly expect to attract the ire of the sport and rights community. And the Commonwealth Games Federation's human rights policy statement was adopted in October 2017, followed by a welcome commitment to a binding policy in the last few weeks. My contention that the synthesis of human rights with the lure of sport and mega sporting events will change the world, therefore, may still require a leap of faith to see what might be, but is demonstrably already changing the lives of tens of millions. Now well into the second half, with the clock ticking down and the game on the line, let us maintain our game face, dig in, and as the going gets tough, we turn to some individual cases to stress both the value of sport's social perforation and of a human rights approach. Let us return to Adam Goods. If the AFL was similarly obligated under international human rights law, what might have been different in the career of a great Australian? Racial vilification contravenes customary international law as well as domestic, of course, but crucially on the FIFA policy model, the AFL and his club would have been duty-bound to not only protect, but actively promote Adam's rights. This might in future mean an obligation to actively confront racially discriminatory commentary and to assist Adam in ensuring a safe workplace through challenging stereotypes. Thus, an important discussion is amplified in a positive, educative way, a circumstance now occurring through the thought-provoking and restorative documentary, The Australian Dream, alongside Wiradjuri man Stan Grant. And perhaps that will be the greatest gift that Adam can give. Nevertheless, who knows whether a brilliant career could have been saved? Hopefully this never happens again, but if it does, what will sport do? Australian rugby union player Israel Folau is another highly contentious and yet salient example. And I can hear half the audience draw breath, the other half draw bows, because it's a really difficult issue, particularly when we lack the context in which to approach it. Within a human rights framework, the discussion would have been not about contractual rights, but universal instruments and an appropriate balance between freedom of speech and religious views and the right to non-discrimination on behalf of the communities impugned. Risks would have been identified during the audit process and both the athlete and the LGBTI communities concerned listened to and addressed. It would be a very different discussion that would raise the rights discourse, not threaten it. And one reason why many of us believe that such divisive debates could be avoided should Australia implement a Charter of Rights as the only Western democracy to have failed to do so. I feel for the sport, for Israel, and particularly for the LGBTI community who've had to fight far too many battles over far too many decades, and it might have been managed less controversially with the appropriate processes and expertise in place. It is, in fact, the model case for the movement and could have been an opportunity to shape the public mind towards a fairer, safer society for all. The balance is not always a simple one to strike, but human rights is the bedrock on which the discussion must rest. Can sport help us all have difficult national discussions in a reasonable, measured manner that carries Australia issue by issue to a better place? If we can teach the next generation how to approach complex issues through firstly recognising the underlying rights they all possess and must respect in others, then sport will have achieved something very meaningful indeed. And need we spend countless hours debating whether Caster Semenya, the Olympic gold medal-winning South African middle distance runner, should, as part of a cohort of female athletes with differences of sex development, undergo treatment to lower her testosterone to fit within the sports regulatory framework, as is the wish of the International Association of Athletics Federation, IAAF, and as legitimised by CAS? No. We've got better things to do, frankly. Caster's rights to the dignity, bodily integrity and bodily autonomy of her person are paramount in the new sports world. A point made by the UN Human Rights Council in March this year. Now that Caster is a footballer, having joined a women's professional team in South Africa, the question for now is moot, as she's protected by the very policy the absence of which was her undoing. President of the IAAF, Sebastian Coe, even went so far as to state that the IAAF is not a public authority exercising state powers, but rather a private body exercising private contractual powers. Therefore, it is not subject to human rights instruments, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or the European Convention on Human Rights. It's staggering that a sport can purport to have no obligation to human rights, and the IAAF stands almost alone as an impedance against universal protections. Again, her case is not straightforward, but if the answer is to chemically or surgically alter the body of the human to fit the sport, we've truly lost our way. So I propose to you tonight that the implementation of human rights in sport will be a key driver in fulfilling the elusive dream of rights universality. There will be growing pains as sport recalibrates its approach to accept that today's educated, socially informed generation of athletes have a right and responsibility to speak out, and whenever governing bodies try to limit the athlete voice, they should be mindful that history very often vindicates the athlete. The International Olympic Committee considered the historic protest by Tommy Smith and John Carlos in 68 as a deliberate and violent breach of the fundamental principles of the Olympic spirit. Many Australians would know that silver medalist on that day, Peter Norman, who stood in solidarity with his American colleagues and wore an Olympic Project for Human Rights badge on the podium, only received an apology from the Parliament of Australia 50 years later, one that the Olympic movement considered unnecessary. And Cathy Freeman's first attempt to display her Indigenous pride at the Commonwealth Games was controversial and led to a flag ban. Presently, athletes often have to speak to social causes through their representative body or union. Professional Footballers Australia, under CEO John Didelitzer, and the Global Professional Athlete Union, World Players United, led by PFA chairman, Australian lawyer and leading proponent of the global movement for athlete rights, Brendan Schwab, were forceful allies. As was FIFPro vice president, Australian lawyer and former Socceroo Francis Awaratifi, and head of communications of the Global Footballers Union, another Australian, Andrew Osati, all very close friends, and I acknowledge and thank them all. As you can very clearly see, it was overwhelmingly players and athletes who represented the sport in advocacy, despite the human rights policy binding the officials. And this is the vacuum that needs to be filled. The players didn't have a policy. We didn't have statutory obligations, an ethics chamber to supposedly hold us to account, or a FIFA Human Rights Advisory Board to report on our progress or lack thereof. We just had our love of the game and belief in the values of solidarity that we hope to keep alive and pass on to the next generation. And a deep conviction that stepping forward to help someone in need, cutting to the heart of the matter, and refusing to give an inch is as Australian as it gets. I would like to see an independent sport and rights institute, perhaps under the Australian Human Rights Commission, and a human rights advisory board which would work with all professional sport. This would assist with the necessary due diligence and risk assessment based on the business and human rights protect, respect, remedy framework, and would develop an holistic approach to the identification, mitigation and avoidance of human rights impacts, as well as the provision of positive rights through the entire sports architecture. It would also assist in the analysis and legacy planning for major sports events bids, such as the Football Federation Australia bid for the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup. Leadership by the Coalition of Major Professional and Participation Sports and the Australian Athletes Alliance, AAA, as the peak representative bodies, would benefit both and provide a framework that builds on their social responsibility in a strategic way, as well as a statutory bridge between them when athletes stand up and speak out. Sport must be a safe place where everyone in society has a right to feel protected, respected, and of equal value. And it can stand proudly for social justice through a rights perspective without keeping score as to whether racket, goggles or ball is more on side with the party or policy of the day. Should all sports have stepped forward for LGBTI rights? They would in fact be obligated under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which prohibits discrimination in Article 2, 1, without distinction of any kind, including on the basis of sexual orientation. This is not an opinion, a personal view, a bias. It's a universal right that the LGBTI community possesses. And the support of FFA, NRL, AFL, Cricket Australia, Netball Australia, Basketball and others was recognition of the social duty of sport. Bravo. Should all sport feel comfortable advocating for Indigenous rights in this country, for reconciliation, constitutional recognition and truth-telling of our history? Yes, indeed. It would be their obligation under the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the right to self-determination. In fact, Football Federation Australia is expected to adhere to FIFA's policy, and it's hugely exciting to ponder what effects this might have on the rights of Indigenous Australians to play football. This is an issue about which I'm especially excited. NRL and Richmond Football Club in particular have been outstanding representatives for Indigenous recognition. In a sport and rights world, so would all others. And should all sport involve itself in working towards a sustainable planet on behalf of its participants? Of course. Aside from being part of the Sustainable Development Goals, it's arguably a human right. As we've seen, for example, in the Lagari case in Pakistan and the landmark decision in Uganda just last year, where the Hague Court of Appeal ruled that the Dutch government had a duty to safeguard against dangerous climate change. The preambular statement in the Paris Agreement that parties respect, promote and consider their respective obligations on human rights when taking action to address climate change is also noteworthy. In Australia's case, this discussion is far from being only about global citizenry, though. It's aspirational and intergenerational. An opportunity to participate in an industry transformation that can underwrite both the well-being of the planet and prosperity of the nation for our kids and theirs. I welcome the commitment by FIFA to the UN Sports for Climate Action Framework, along with UEFA, the World Surf League, Tennis Australia, the IOC, the NBA, and 47 other sporting organisations, and invite the football community in Australia to place our shoulder to the global wheel. The unifying power of football is unparalleled, and as the global game, we're uniquely impacted. The increasing issue of human mobility from environmental factors and climate migration, whether internal or external, is deeply worrying, given what we see in the treatment of displaced people globally today. In 2018 alone, there were an estimated 17.2 million displacements associated with disasters in 148 countries and territories, and drought displaced 764,000 people in Somalia, Afghanistan, and several other countries. No one in football needs reminding that these are our fellow competitors, our community, our global family. And finally, we cannot discount the cool factor. Through sport, the very concept and content of international human rights instruments would not only be more widely understood, but perhaps, as a member of the Indian Sports Law Fraternity suggested recently at a conference that I attended in Bangalore, they might even become cool. In this way, rights may lend some of sport's luminescence. And I can think of nothing cooler than Australian kids understanding and possessing the language to stand up for themselves and others. Moreover, the serve of admiration is returned. When former Australian Human Rights Commission President and now UN Assistant Secretary General Gillian Triggs told me recently that human rights need sport, I replied that yes, that is true. But sport needs the human rights community in equal measure to re-establish the humanitarian values which have undoubtedly been waylaid, as both Hakim and the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who fought for his freedom can attest. When it comes to sport and human rights, Australia is still stretching behind the blocks and going through our warm-up exercises when the gun has long blown. We need to join the sport and rights race in earnest, and why not become an international leader in the field? It will give administrators the jurisdiction, justification, and obligation to support essential social change, give athletes absolute freedom to raise their voices for a better society, and can change the world for the better. In fact, sport is so powerful, so captivating for people and polity alike, that it might even save it. But that is another discussion again, and the final whistle has blown. Let us finish with the great Nelson Mandela, who embodied the two rare triumvirate of compassion, leadership, and political life. And most fittingly, with a well-worn sporting cliche. For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. Because of sport, Hakim Al-Arabi was shackled, and through its remarkable power and the finest qualities of the Australia that we wish to see, he and his wife are now set free. But through human rights, sport too is at last becoming unchained. And the human race will be the winner. Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes for questions. I just am blown away by that. I don't know what you think, but the passion with which Craig speaks about these issues, and not just two or three aspects of sport and human rights, he's across so many different areas and brings the passion that he brings to the commentary I've always liked on SBS football to these really important causes. So we do have, I can also see that law degree has been coming in handy as well. We have time for questions, so we'll take a few of those. I might open though by asking you, Craig, do you think that Australian sports people and athletes are as up to this challenge as much as some of the examples we see overseas? So I know next week you're going to be in the US talking to Colin Kaepernick, Megan Rapinoe, and, you know, Kaepernick's someone who's paid a huge price for his stance in relation to the national anthem in the US and the treatment of black Americans. You know, probably won't play NFL again, or good chance that he won't. Lost all his sponsorships, but took a really important stand. Do you see Australian sports people fitting that mould, following that example?
Each country has different issues that all of these athletes feel strongly about, and civil rights, of course, in the US has been a long-standing issue which many athletes over a long period of time have added their voice to, including Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Muhammad Ali and so on. And Colin is the latest. Sadly, he's been out of sport for 3 years, and that's a disgrace on sport, because under this framework, they would be obligated to understand the rights that he's advocating for. In our domestic context, I talked about Cathy Freeman, and Adam Goods is another really great one. But for Cathy, when she first was at the Commonwealth Games and took, I think, the Australian flag and the Aboriginal flag and wanted to show her pride in both, that was amazing that sport would say, that's political. But how is that political? What she's expressing is her pride in what is her background, and she should have the right to do so. I think that people in future like Colin Kaepernick will have immense amount of support from their fellow athletes and from other sports around the world once this framework is implemented across all sports. So in FIFA, in football with FIFA, it's been extremely powerful. And as I said before, getting the officials to uphold it is the greatest challenge that we face today. You know, nevertheless, we have a benchmark for the first time against which we can argue for the rights of someone like Hakeem or Sahar Kodiari. The difference between the two is really critical to understand, and it's very simply that both could have been gone. And it shouldn't require players, athletes, to go and barge through the door to make sure that one of those two is able to sit in here tonight. So that's the big challenge, and it's a really difficult one because sport is internally, endemically political. That's why we had to do it. And I think we had the advantage of really understanding the internal dynamics of sport. That was our sport. That was also really important. We had people involved in the back, and you know, and most of us had been in advocacy for players' rights, actually against governing bodies for over 2.5 decades. So we knew what the context is. We knew how people operate within that system, and we knew how to cut straight through and put them in an uncomfortable position, which meant that a political solution could be opened. So the framework to be able to hold all of these sports and officials to account is really a huge project now. You know, the human rights community has, and I've kind of landed in the middle of all of this because of Hakeem, right? And they've been working over a really long period to try and mitigate what are really heinous impacts of these mega sporting events. And through crises in a number of the contexts, and also through pressure on the sponsors, so through commercial pressure and the reputational and brand damage that was starting to occur, they were able to then be able to implement a really strong policy. For the players and the athletes, they're not quite aware yet of this framework. So I think really, from what I can see, it's quite new to Australia. You know, because Hakeem's case was international, was Bahrain, was international football and other countries involved, it landed us in the middle of this context. And in my personal view, when athletes are educated in this manner and understand what their rights are, or they can ground their advocacy, which they feel so strongly about, and rightly so, you know, as, and then many of these athletes are far more successful in a sporting sense than I ever was. You know, they're huge sporting stars, but I understand their strong sense of responsibility to society and to give back. But there's a lack of sometimes understanding, there's a lack of training, and there's not a framework which provides them with any measurable areas on which they can feel safe. Yep. So through Hakeem's campaign, I kept talking to people about a safe space, and we were able to bring all sport into it. So, you know, the rugby union players here were marvellous, and we had, you know, 30 great athletes send a letter to Scott Morrison, and we had Olympic athletes come out, Ian Thorpe, and Steve Hooker was brilliant, and
We have seen people stand up.
Guys came out, but the important part is that it's because we created a safe zone, because we grounded what was happening to him in a really solid human rights framework, very clearly. And particularly I made sure that we did not deviate from that. Mm. We were attacking Bahrain on international law. We weren't attacking Bahrain because it was fun. Mm. So in other words, you know, the same with the government here. When half of Australia, if not more, and the global football community and sports fans, millions of people, when the successful resolution was found and Hakeem arrived back home and was able to go, we went down to see the government, and that was also really important. And a lot of people said, well, you know, we've got this immigration policy over here, and we've got these things, you know, that we all want to talk about, and I think we need to talk about that. That's why I talk about difficult national discussions. But the Australian government did a fabulous job for Hakeem Al-Arabi. Maurice Payne was unbelievable, and Scott Morrison did a brilliant job by the end once he was activated, and he was in a situation where he had to. And my view for Hakeem, my view for Australia actually, is that I'm going to give him credit for that. Right? Because what too often happens is people say, well, I don't like them over here, and therefore whatever they do that's actually good, I'm not going to acknowledge it. Mm. And sport creates a safe place in the middle. And all I'm saying, was saying and am saying, is that we can have this discussion without being anti-person, or we're just pro-human rights. We're just pro-compassion. We are pro-empathy. We're pro-taking Australia to a good place. And I spend a lot of time in the human rights community and other communities. And I think, you know, that's a big challenge. The big challenge is that we've lost in a lot of ways, I think, the ability to just have a really good discussion and not to use these issues to try and make the other side look bad.
Yep. Which often happens. Yeah.
And certainly in the refugee space, I think it's been going on too long. And it's time for Australia to say, you know, people of all persuasions and whatever views you have on what may have happened or what you think, no one in Australia accepts or is proud of people being in pain under our care. I mean, this is not possible. Mm. And people of all the extractions in Australia, I believe, agree with that. So I think sport has demonstrated through that campaign a really powerful ability to facilitate these discussions in a safe way.
Okay, so let's open it up. Probably got time for a few questions. I did see a hand up earlier. There are roving mics. If you could just identify yourself and make it a brief question, that'd be great, thank you. Stand up if you like, whichever. Is the mic working?
Absolutely, can you hear me?
Yeah,
Peter Permanuel. Every person's got a right to be respected, accepted, and emboldened. Also at the same time, through your delivery, you showed leadership. Leadership not as a person, but as a group. Because to be able to do something like constructive like this, you need leaders. What a government needs is leaders. However, considering at the same time we have so many refugees coming into our country who assume, as a comment is directed through the media, I'm black, they can't touch me. Or other issues like they use a legal system to be able to extend their stay. How do you measure the effectiveness of a government in its policy?
Okay, so look, thank you for the question. I can see that you feel really strongly about it. I think what's important tonight, in my view, is that what I would like to do, if you don't mind, is stay where we've just talked about here, and that is that our treatment of all people should be really important to us. So, you know, we talked about human rights here, and they are universal, and every person who has a right to seek asylum has a right to be treated humanely. I mean, that's, you know, and to think, I mean, So I'd prefer all governments have been involved in what has happened to this country in the last 20 years. Yeah? And I would just like us to see that we can get past that. And everyone has a role to play, and advocating with or against the government is important for a number of sectors of society. In my view, we need to come together as people and actually put that aside and say we cannot allow anyone to be treated in this way. The fact that Australia is having trouble working out whether we should help sick children have medical support is just staggering, that we could be there. And I think there's a growing sector of Australian society who feel the same way as I do, and I'm sure as many of the audience do. It is a difficult subject. It is a complex subject, right? And that's the point here. That's what we're talking about tonight. It is not straightforward. And I think too often at the moment, people, we're taking extreme views and simplify. It is difficult. All I would like to see is the best minds in Australia come to the table and work out what is a humane solution in the best interests of the humans who are involved and of the country. That's all that we need to do. We're capable of doing it. But no one is saying that it's straightforward. It is not. That's why we have to have everyone together. We can do it. I think Australia is ready to do it. And I'm hopeful that what has occurred, not just with Hakeem, but with in a range of cases, demonstrates that for all of us, we want an Australia that we're proud of in every respect. And to do that, we need to make some necessary changes in the way we deal with vulnerable people.
Okay. Another question. I think there's someone with their hand up sort of towards the middle.
Thanks very much, Phil. I was a huge fan, long-time fan. Always enjoyed your analysis of the World Cup. Foz, a lot of what you talked about was the power of sporting bodies in making change and sort of holding countries to account on human rights. Mm. One thing I think is a huge challenge looking at specifically football bodies, and I think you mentioned a few FIFA and the AFC, is that there's a lot of corruption, especially at the top level. And I think a lot of that corruption sort of comes from partly the excessive amount of money in sport. And I'm interested, sort of a two-part question. Firstly, do you think there is an inherent problem in the sort of excessive amount of money that's flowing into football at the moment? And secondly, how can we sort of best address that corruption at the highest levels of sporting bodies?
Okay, thank you for the question. That's a big one. So let me just relate it to this framework that we're talking about tonight. It actually can have a really significant impact on the level of governance of the sport. Why? Is because many of the people who are challenged in governance ethics are also challenged and have significant pasts in relation to treatment of people. I'll give you an example. So a perfect example was sitting here. So throughout the Hakeem scenario, the president of the AFC, who is Bahraini, was obligated to tell his own government to use, by this language, to use maximum leverage with governments and other key stakeholders, to have his own government and his own football association, of which he's formerly president, advocate for them to withdraw their extradition order and to uphold internationally recognised law. What happened after that is that we had an election in April 6th, and the eligibility criteria and the FIFA Ethics Committee had to vet all of the candidates, including on their record and commitment to that. And yet, there was no challenge there. You had the two I've talked about earlier, and particularly the Afghanistan official who was at the time suspended. It clearly is not working. But when it does, that's a big change. It's a change for two reasons. Number one, the type of candidate who can come into positions of authority is going to change. And secondly, when these things occur, they're going to be challenged. And when they demonstrate capability or incapability of advocating against the people for whom, who have worked to place them there, or against the people from where all this financial influence is coming, that's going to be the real test. That's one reason why I'm so excited about it, is because I can see what the effect is going to be on the level, the quality, the human qualities of the people who are going to be able to rise to high governance positions. Does that make sense? To do that, though, we're going to need some type of regulatory chamber which actually can advocate. And at the moment, they're not there. They're simply not there because it's still quite new. Hakim was the first big test in football. And what the, I think, human rights community realised was that actually, as much as we advocated, if we didn't rush in and knock down the door, there is nothing that would have been done or that we could have done. Yeah? So now the rush is on to say, okay, in the next situation, how is it that we can make this occur without that campaign? And what we said afterward was, fabulous, thank you to everyone, it was incredible. It was an unbelievable demonstration of what Australia is able to achieve. I stood at the Melbourne airport, and I had to watch it back the other day for some reason, which I never do, and I spoke so ineloquently because of emotion and other things. But all
a bit
I kept
tired, I would have thought.
A bit tired.
Around the world, trying
but
to say.
All I kept saying was, "I'm so proud of Australia. I'm proud of Australians. I'm proud of this. I'm proud of everyone." It's just horrible. But for someone who makes their living talking, it was really bad. But you could see that was the genuine emotion. I was incredibly proud of what this country had achieved, and I think after what we've been through, and the kind of the feeling that we all have, so many of us have, that we just need to move on from some of these issues. It was an opportunity of inspiration for a lot of us to come together in an area which has been fraught and be able to have a really positive impact. And that's incredible. But the first thing we said was, what happens to the next Hakim? Because we can't go and run that campaign again. And as we said, he was a unique victim. If I might say while I'm here, and John Didalitz is sitting down here, the CEO of the Australian Union, and one of the greatest decisions I've made in my history since being a player was to have him appointed as the CEO, which is doing a brilliant job. The players' union in Australia and Brendan at World Players were unbelievably strong. Hakim was not even a member. Not even a member. He is now.
I was going to say, you signed him up.
He wasn't even a member. And so they had a meeting and asked the executive, his Socceroos, Matildas, and the contemporary players in the middle of their career. And they said, what are you going to do about this kid? And they didn't say, well, who the hell is he? They said, he's a player, Pascaval, okay, he's not a member. Yeah, we're going to go and get him. And they put their lives on hold, as did I, and as did so many people. That's extraordinary. That's Australia. It's unbelievable what came out of football and out of sport there. But the next person needs the system to save them. And what that looks like, that's actually a really, really big challenge. Because the people there at the moment you can imagine how much they really desire having a good independent regulatory chamber in human rights. So that's going to be a real challenge.
Well, Craig, the eloquence of your answers tonight has meant that we've run out of time for any further questions. But thank you so much again for such a wonderful lecture. You broke the mould in terms of lectures. It was so engaging and interesting. I'm thrilled that so many people were here to see it. Even more will be able to listen to it in coming weeks on Radio National's Big Ideas. And there's also a program being made about Craig that'll appear soon. Craig and the Safe Hakeem campaign.
And Hakeem.
Appearing on ABC's Australian Story ahead of a book coming out towards the end of October, I believe.
That's true. Yeah, so let me just comment on that. So the thing about the book is that it tells a lot of the story of Hakeem, and the reason for having it written is to thank Australia. The reason for having it written is because what we did together was so unbelievable that I think we need to capture the essence of how we acted and how we felt, and we need to transfer that across for all asylum seekers and all vulnerable people. What we were able to feel, I want us to feel all the time, that pride in who we are and where we're going. That's why we had the book written.
Okay, terrific. The recognition of your work is also now global. So later this week, Craig's heading to New York to address the UN General Assembly session on protection of social, economic and cultural rights. I mentioned he's meeting with some leading athletes who have been prominent in advancing human rights causes over there. We've obviously been delighted that you've been able to spend time and share your thoughts with us tonight. Please join me again in thanking Craig.
Thank you. Thanks, Craig. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
And
appreciate it.
I do have a couple of gifts to give you. I've been worded up that you don't mind a drop of Pinot by your wife, Lara, who was also very instrumental in organising tonight, for which we're very grateful.
Yes.
I just want to thank a number of people. This event's been sort of 6 months in the making. Mm. The College of Business events team, Ellen Ong, Lauren Gotiles, Rekha Ryan, Patricia Vo, Alyssa Pullum, and many others who have been here helping out tonight. Thanks for making it such a success. Thanks also to our school's professional staff, Sue Brennan and her team, to our Dean, Professor Kathy Douglas, for supporting the event. And finally, thanks again, everyone, for attending. It's been great to have so many people here. There are now networking drinks in the foyer and the salon outside. So thanks very much again for coming.
All right, thank you.